In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the current relationship between the governments of Iran and the United States. And certainly, tensions between the two countries have been running high over the last 5 years or so, particularly since 2002, when President Bush, in his State of the Union address, said that Iran was part of an axis of evil. The United States has said that Iran is a sponsor of terrorism. There also has been a very big issue between the two countries, and that is the charge by the United States that Iran is interested in building nuclear weapons. For its part, the government of Iran says its interest is only in the peaceful development of nuclear power. And there's a lot of concern, particularly here in the United States, about the possibility that there could actually be military conflict involving Iran and the United States. So we'll be trying to talk a little bit about Iran, Iranian politics, and about this relationship in this part of Focus 580 with Behruz Ghamari Tabrizi. He is a assistant professor of history and sociology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champain. And we're pleased to have you here in the studio with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
As we talk, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And we'd be happy to have whatever questions that people have. I'm not exactly sure where the point to begin would be. Obviously, relations between the two countries have been strained really ever since the Iranian Revolution. So it's been some time since there was normal relations between the two countries. Mm-hmm. Things particularly got even more tense with President Bush and his axis of evil speech. And then with the election of President Ahmadinejad in Iran. So here we have two leaders who don't seem particularly interested in talking. They talk at one another. They don't really talk with one another. How concerned do you think we should be? Maybe that's a place to start. How concerned do you think we should be here in the United States about the possibility that there might actually be conflict, military conflict, more than just words, between the two countries?
I think we should be quite concerned, actually, about the possibility of a war. Not that I think that either countries are planning to start a war, but often in these kind of circumstances, when we see a very, very intense rhetoric and escalation of all the situation, the possibility that I'm worried about is that the start of an unintended war. Just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Had a very large military exercise in the Persian Gulf, and we need to realize how close the U.S. warships are to the Iranian coasts, and just a matter of, you know, an accident might be the spark that starts a war between the two countries. So in that sense, I think we need to be very, very concerned. That said, it doesn't mean that a planned war is not going to happen either. Mm-hmm. And how to stop that is going to be a very, very difficult proposition to wrestle with. But that possibility is definitely there.
Well, obviously, Iran is interested in enhancing its position as a power in the region. And that is something that the United States is obviously very concerned about. Do you think that it is the case that the United States is going to have to come to some kind of an accommodation with the fact that Iran is and will continue to be one of the most powerful players in the region?
Well, I think that it is true that Iran does want to be a player in the region. And of course, I think, you know, any other country in the region would have the same kind of ambitions. And it shouldn't come as a surprise to think that Iran wants to be a player in the region, which it considers its own region, of course. And I think that a possibility of cooperation with the U.S. And Iran was really on the table, and I'm glad you started your introduction with the reference to President Bush's Axis of Evil State of the Union speech. And I want to contextualize that a little bit so we understand better how shocking for the Iranians that assertion was, that suddenly they were part of Axis of Evil at the time that after 9/11, Iran was actually the only country in the Middle East in which we saw people spontaneously held candlelight vigils on the streets of Iranian big cities, and Iranian president sent condolences and immediately condemned the terrorist actions on 9/11. And most importantly, Iran, according to all the American negotiators, was very, very instrumental in facilitating the transitional government of Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan. And there was a conference in the German city of Bonn, and James Dobbins, who represented the U.S. in the conference, said after the conference that basically without Iranian intervention, the transitional government of Hamid Karzai could not have materialized. And the Iranians promised $500 million of aid to pay for the changes in Afghanistan government, the post-Taliban government. And everything seemed that everything was on the right track for the U.S. and Iran to cooperate, actually, on this war on terrorism. And it's only in that context that suddenly Iranians hear the State of the Union speech in which Iran was put right at the center of axis of evil. And I was reading the Iranian daily newspaper, the editorials, and how shocked they were that after all this cooperation, and the Iranians even told the American forces that they would be willing to help them out in their military operations in Afghanistan, and they indeed blocked the Iranian borders and stopped the fleeing Taliban forces to cross the border to Iran. And so in that context, I think it was quite possible. It was a sort of a golden opportunity, one might say, to see a change in Iran and U.S. relations. And unfortunately, you know, after the Axis of Evil talk, all those bets were off. And then matters became more complicated when the Iranian reformist administration of President Khatami lost the election to the current president, who came to power with a very, very radical agenda and very anti-American platform to power.
Do you I want to have you talk a little bit about Iranian politics in a moment, but just to pick up on the point that you made, do you think that concerns about the United States influenced the vote at all? And did, if there was uncertainty in Iran, if people were concerned about the possibility that there was a threat posed to the United States, did that help in the election of President Ahmadinejad?
Well, there are two things that helped the election of President Ahmadinejad. I mean, one thing I want to emphasize here that for a lot of people, hearing that Iran holds presidential elections actually might come as a surprise. Iran has a very complicated quasi-democratic system in which there are, you know, elected body that governs the state, and also unelected officials who oversee and control the actions of the elected body. But that's a different topic altogether. But the election was quite important in the sense that all the time that the Iranian president Khatami, a reformist, very liberal-minded president, was in power, the U.S. position was that the Iranian presidents don't have that much authority in making policies in Iran. And Iranian expatriate television, satellite TVs, there are 12 of them out of Los Angeles, many of them funded by the American government, and they beam all these propaganda into Iran, and they ask Iranians to boycott the election, the presidential election. And of course, when you encourage people, or discourage rather, people from participating in an election, you end up with people participating in an election who are hardcore constituents of different parties. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, hardcore constituents of Ahmadinejad participated in election. Not that there were a very limited number of people. There still were between 55% to 60% of people participated in election and elected Ahmadinejad as their president. And there's also a lot of skepticism about the U.S. intentions in relation to Iran. Because on the one hand, the U.S. has, in my opinion, a very misguided policy of regime change in Iran. and allocates large amounts of money, $75 million in 2006, for the promotion of democracy in Iran. And on the other hand, U.S. wants to see Iranian government commit itself to the demands of American policymakers. So there is an inherent contradiction in there from the point of view of the Iranian government. So in that sense, I think that one thing needs to be resolved in American approach to Iranian regime, and that problem is that either the U.S. recognizes the Islamic Republic as the legitimate representative of Iranian people, or it doesn't, and then all bets are off. There are no negotiations. You cannot negotiate with the government. You don't recognize its legitimacy. So in that sense, Iranians, on the one hand, are skeptical of American intentions. On the other hand, they do want to reestablish their relationship with the American government in a very sort of equal footing. When you refer to Iran-U.S. relations before revolution as a normal relationship, that's not how Iranians view that relationship, of course, because when you ask Iranians to think about their relationship with America, their point of departure is 1953 American coup.
Right.
And that's the point of reference. They say, okay, there was a coup d'etat in 1953. The U.S. supported a very tyrannical regime in Iran. And by no means that relationship from Iranian point of view was normal, of course. And it was they considered that relationship a very colonial relationship. Iranians lost their political, economic independence. And after the revolution, it was an attempt on the Iranian people to be politically and economically independent. And this is truly at the core of their agenda even today. And as one of the head of the Iran desk at the State Department once said, that Iranians are more concerned with independence, economic, political independence at home rather than dominion abroad. And that's their main concern. And in that sense, Iranians have shown in the last 25 years that they are quite pragmatic. If they see ways that they can maintain their independence, they would take that route.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's a very, very important to put in that kind of context as you had, as unfortunately, when it comes to foreign policy, I think here in the United States, we have rather short memories, and that the countries with which we're dealing, they have memories that are longer, and that certainly that people in Iran would think about the involvement of the United States in Iranian politics going back before the revolution, and we just think about 2 weeks ago. So I think that that's a very important point. Let me just take a second to introduce again our guest. In this hour, Focus 5, Hedi Behrouz Ghemari Tabrizi. He is assistant professor of history and sociology here at University of Illinois. We're talking about Iran and relations between Iran and the United States. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Having said that, the things that you just said, that it seems to fit with the notion, at least the notion that I had initially reading about the last presidential election in which Mr. Ahmadinejad was elected, that what really drove that was domestic concerns, and that a lot of his popularity came from the fact that he was a populist, he was a nationalist, and particularly he said to people in the country that felt they weren't doing well that he was going to do something about that. I'm not sure that he has, but he seemed to be speaking to middle-class people or lower-middle-class people or working-class people and said, we're going to do something to improve the quality of your life. And that kind of appeal had a lot to do with why it was that he got elected and not anything to do with anything he might have said about Iran and geopolitics.
That is absolutely correct. He came to power with the social justice agenda. And this was one of the areas that the reformists neglected, and they emphasized issues of civil liberties, establishment of civil society, issues of human rights were very, very central in the previous administration's agenda. But meanwhile, the divisions between different classes enlarged in Iran during 8-year Khatami administration. And of course, much of it is structural issues in Iranian economy, and there is a lot of pressure on Iranian economy from U.S. embargo and U.S. actions retaliating against companies with investment in Iran, and that's partly to blame. But of course, you know, like any other developing countries in the world, Iran has chronic economic issues, and Ahmadinejad took advantage of those issues and introduced a very potent, very important social justice program, and was elected to the office based on that agenda. And it was quite interesting to see how that agenda changed a few months after he was elected, and the nuclear issue became very central in the mission of his administration, mm-hmm. and nuclear technology became the national pride of Iran, and that was something that he thought that he could exploit in generating more and more support for his administration. Meanwhile, economic situation in Iran is worsening. The issues of civil liberty and the crackdown on opposition is getting worse by the day. And but Iranians are still, you know, trying to find a way to hang on to wait for the next elections and hopefully re-elect a more reformist and more open-minded administration to power.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who is listening in Champagne on line number one. Hello.
Yes, my concern every day is the instability in the Middle East. It seems to be growing exponentially. And the worst thing that I could imagine happening now is for, quote-unquote, the crazies in the current administration to militarily attack Iran to eliminate whatever nuclear activity it's engaged in. My sense of concern was heightened most recently when Senator Joe Lieberman came back from Iraq and expressed that maybe we had to take military action against Iran because of their interference with our effort in Iraq. And I'm just really worried that if we don't attack, maybe Israel as our proxy may militarily attack Iran, and I just think that would throw the Middle East into nothing but pure havoc. What are your thoughts about that?
You are exactly correct that Lieberman's comments were quite controversial, and I don't think that Lieberman actually is representing the dominant opinion in the Bush administration at this point. It is true that there are crazies, as you put it, in the Bush administration.
I put that in quotes. Somebody else used the term crazies, even though I might adopt that. But go on. I'm sorry.
but you know, we call it, there is actually a doctrine, military doctrine, that's been in use for the entire 20th century, that in order to win a war, you need to act a little bit like crazy. So your enemy would perceive you as mad and capable of any action. And this is a campaign of intimidation, of course. And if your enemy thinks that you're capable of anything, that the chances of them being intimidated is much higher. But this is an important issue, and I don't think that the administration is unaware of the catastrophic consequences of any military action against Iran. But as I said, my main worry about the possibility of war in Iran with Iran is a sort of an unintended military action rather than a planned one at
okay.
this point.
All right, thank you, sir.
Thanks for the call. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about the current confrontation between the two countries over the nuclear issue. The United States has continued to maintain that it's concerned that the government of Iran is interested in developing and building nuclear weapons. And the position, the official position of the government of Iran has said, no, we're not interested in nuclear weapons. What we are interested in is the peaceful development of nuclear power as an energy source. And the government of Iran says, we believe that we have every right to do that. Do you think that, in fact, the government of Iran whatever they might indeed be interested in developing nuclear power. But do you think that, in fact, the government of Iran is also interested in developing nuclear weapons?
Well, that's an interesting question that nobody really can answer. There are definitely factions in the government who are thinking of the possibility, at least not if not developing nuclear weapons, at least the know-how that that's in their agenda. But I think one of the important things to realize is that what is given as fact in this nuclear crisis is the question of Iranian non-compliance. Iranians actually are not in non-compliance of a non-proliferation treaty. Everything Iranians have done so far is within the agenda of the non-proliferation treaty, the NPT, and even the clandestine construction of their nuclear sites, which came to light in 2002, was not in violation of NPT, because according to NPT, Iran was supposed, was obliged to report any nuclear facilities 180 days before introducing fissile material to the plant. So in that sense, technically speaking, they were not still in violation of their NPT obligations at the time. And when the news came out that the Iranians were building all these sites, in August 2003, there was a Paris Agreement between Iran and EU3, three European countries, Great Britain, Germany, and France. And in that agreement, which was a very, very positive step, Iranians agreed to what they called an additional protocol to allow IAEA, International Atomic Agency, to install their cameras in all the Iranian nuclear facilities and agreed to snap inspections. These are unannounced, very, very intrusive inspections of all their sites in order to show a measure of confidence building. And in return, Europeans agreed to help Iran technologically to develop their nuclear technology, to have control and under the supervision of European powers, and they gave them economic incentives to do so. But after 3 years of this additional protocol, nothing has changed in the U.S. or European positions vis-a-vis Iranian nuclear technology. And indeed, in 2006, 4 days before the U.N. Security Council condemned Iran for non-compliance, only 4 days before that, IAEA issued a report saying that they have found no evidence of any military component to Iranian nuclear technology. Iranians even allowed IAEA inspectors to go to their military sites, which was not part of the additional protocol. But nevertheless, the result was the same. From Iranian perspective, they waited 3 years. They suspended their enrichment program. And still the position of European 3 and the U.S. was the same. So from their perspective, while Europeans are trying to put all these conditions on Iranians, they won't deliver their own part, and Iranians decided to go ahead and continue their enrichment program, which, by the way, still I reiterate that, is within the NPT obligations. They are not in non-compliance. They are not violating any of their obligations at this point.
Hmm. I think that some people would make the argument that it's very, with a country like Iran, provided that it has the resources and that it has the technology, it would be very difficult, short of extreme measures, to prevent a country from developing a nuclear weapon if that country was determined to do it. I think that there are some people that make the argument that if Iran decides to develop weapons, that we might just have, the rest of the world just might have to live with that, and that in fact that is something that we might live with.
I think that this is a very important point, because I think the question of developing nuclear weapons is not a technical question. This is not about know-how. This is not about technology. This is a political question, and what motivates Iran or any other country in the world to even think about nuclear deterrence is their threat assessment, their perception of what kind of threats are around them that compels them to develop nuclear weapons as a deterrent. Again, I mean, even if Iran develops nuclear weapons, we need to understand that that development is a measure to deter other countries to attack Iran. Iran does not even have an offensive plan to attack any other country, completely to the opposite of whatever other commentators are arguing. But Iranian threat assessment is important. It's important to understand how Iranians perceive themselves in the context of being at the center of all this attention, all these threats. Israel, Prime Minister, Minister of Defense, every day or every other week they make another threat that we are going to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities. The U.S. has a very open plan for overthrowing Iranian government. We talk about regime change in Iran. So for a country who perceives itself to be besieged by all these hostile forces, obviously thinking about developing nuclear weapons shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody who is following the politics of the region. So in this sense, I want to, again, take that question back to its political context rather than a technological issue of know-how and science of nuclear weapons, or shall we supervise them, how much intervention should the IAEA make in this matter. No, this is a political issue, and it should be treated as such.
Mm-hmm. Well, just I have a caller here I want to get to right in a second, but just to follow up on that just a little bit further, one might say that if the government of Iran had a couple of nuclear weapons and the United States decided to attack Iran, that wouldn't help particularly. If you look at regional threats, though, do you see any reasonable threats coming from somewhere else there in the region? Who are the Iranians really worried about?
The Iranians are worried about Israel. The Iranians, of course, are worried about American presence in the region. We have close to 170,000 soldiers on the ground in Iraq. We have a very, very heavy presence in Persian Gulf. All the Persian Gulf states are armed to the teeth by the latest military hardware. And so Iranians are very much concerned about these threats. And of course, Pakistan is another wild card in the region. And I think that, you know, when we think about the question of nuclear weapons, Pakistan is the country that we need to worry about in terms of its stability and in terms of its, you know, possession of nuclear weapons, that we don't discuss that often.
Well, that... Indeed, both India and Pakistan have demonstrated the capability to build nuclear weapons, and there the primary concern is longstanding tensions between those two countries. But having said that, do you think that in fact that the fact that India and Pakistan are both nuclear powers and they're there in the neighborhood that has influenced if indeed Iran wants to develop nuclear weapons, is that how much of that is concerned about India-Pakistan? And in fact, if that was off the table, if those weren't nuclear powers, would there be as much interest in Iran in becoming nuclear power?
I don't think Iranians are concerned per se about Pakistani nuclear weapons. But, you know, again, it introduces a certain kind of culture, a military culture that, you know, Pakistan now has it, India now has it, and then in a sense it becomes a matter of national pride, exactly the way it was for Pakistanis and for Indians. And Israel has it, and nobody talks about it. So Iran feels, in a sense, that in order to be a regional player, to be influential in the region, and to be taken seriously, maybe possessing nuclear weapons is the path they should take.
We are just a bit past our midpoint here. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi. He is Assistant Professor of History and Sociology here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about Iran, U.S.-Iran relations. We have a couple of callers here standing by. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign County here where we are. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Besides the NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty, and all the other admonitions to demilitarize the world, kind of sounds ironic, even saying it now, or futile, but after the first Gulf War, there were protocols signed which called for an attempt to try to denuclearize the region. Nothing has gone on. The U.S. is still selling weapons. Britain is still selling weapons, mad one after another. So I just I think that would be a place to start, it seems to me, actually fulfilling those things. But I actually wanted to talk to you about the real state of war. It seems to be the case now. Everyone talks about proxy wars in Lebanon. What about, can you enlighten us about what you think is going on? Cy Hirsch wrote about this in New Yorker maybe almost a year ago now, saying that the U.S. already had sort of intelligence operatives going in to the region, or into Iran, I'm saying, and that there's also this arming these various peculiar groups, some of which are on the ground, some of which are more based in Paris, like the MEK. So I just, you know, it seems to me there already is a de facto state of war in some regards, and the U.S., as far as accidentally producing a casus belli, they can pretty much do it anytime they want to. They can just say that they've gotten more evidence and manufactured or not about involvement, Iranian involvement in Iraq. I'd like to know what you know about that personally or from your readings.
Very, very good point. Let me just say something about the first point you made about arming arm race in the region. A while ago, I think it was last month, that President Carter wrote an editorial talking about the most significant non-compliant client of NPT, which was the U.S. At this administration, because as we know now, we spent more than $40 billion a year in maintaining and developing new nuclear weapons in the U.S. And as part of a non-proliferation treaty, the U.S. was obliged to help to disarm, and disarmament was part of NPT. And now we are spending more and more on new. Now they talk about the development of tactical nuclear weapons, bunker busters, earth-penetrating missiles, and so on and so forth. And also in the Pentagon report, talk about in 2006. It clearly talks about Iran as one of the places that there is a possibility of using one of these tactical nuclear weapons. They call them the small weapons. Of course, these are small, but more powerful than the bombs in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So that's how small they are. On the second point, it is true the U.S. is engaged in multiple ways of destabilizing the Iranian government. One thing, which is, of course, very small, these democracy projects, funding of the different groups, opposition groups, radio stations, television stations. These are basically propaganda tools that the funds come from the U.S. government, and it is really damaging any kind of reformist movement, democratic movement in Iran, because now you might have heard of the arrest of four American-Iranian dual citizens in the last couple of months on the charges of espionage. And since the U.S. is not open about who actually receives these State Department funds for promotion of democracy in Iran, now anybody who is working on democratic issues in Iran is a suspect. And in so many different ways, that has undermined democratic movements, reformist movements in Iran. And this is only those people who pay the price of, again, another misguided policy. On the other front, it is true that the U.S. is helping and funding different ethnic groups. Iran is a multi-ethnic nation. Two major ethnic groups in Iran are Azeris, who are 22-23% of the population, and the Kurdish population, which is 5-7% of the population. And the U.S. Has been working with a number of different groups to fund the possibility of ethnic unrest in Iran. And we occasionally hear stories about these clashes between Azeri groups and the Kurdish groups inside Iran. I should not suggest that all the issues between different ethnic groups with the central government in Iran is the creation of U.S. administration. There are long-standing issues of ethnic discriminations in Iran, but nevertheless, the U.S. is trying to exploit that issue for destabilizing the central government. Also, what you refer to as Cy Hirsch report, it is true that there is this Al-Qaeda-type group based in Pakistan called Jundullah. And they've been raiding inside Iranian territories, and there are estimates that between 300 to 400 Iranian soldiers have been killed by Jundullah, and it came out that the U.S. Has ties to the leaders of Jundullah, and they work with the Pakistani intelligence services in providing them with arms and other resources for these operations inside Iran. So in that sense, again, the U.S. is trying to destabilize the Iranian regime.
That latter story actually did show up on ABC, if I recall, but you don't hear anybody comment much about it after the fact. It seems that arming an al-Qaeda group, which the allegations also doing that in Lebanon to some peculiar consequences, it seems. One would think that that would come up in the discourse, but...
Well, the only place I heard after the ABC news, Mitt Romney actually criticized ABC for reporting on the topic, and he said that this is a matter of our national security, and we are at war, and during the wartime, ABC should be more discriminate in reporting actions of American government. But I don't know, the last time I checked, we were not at war with Iran, so I don't understand why should ABC be concerned about reporting on these covert operations that the U.S. is engaged with. Lebanon situation is another topic, but I don't think that we have time to get into that. But definitely arming of pro-Al-Qaeda elements in Palestinian refugee camps is one of the issues, that underlying issues of what's going on in Lebanon. In the last couple of weeks, there are definite Saudi connections with these groups in Palestinian refugee camps. But of course, we always hear about the Syrian-Iranian connection, and again, the Saudi ties are swept under the rug very conveniently.
Yeah, I'll go now. But it seems to me it's kind of curious that even in Ethiopia and Somalia, the Somalis are getting more aid from the Saudis than any other single source, it seems to me, and that also is conveniently not spoken of. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's go on to talk with someone else in Kankakee, line number 4. Hello.
The balancing presence of a strong Iran and a strong Iraq has been disrupted by the destabilization of the Iraqi state by an outside invader. This seems to this caller that there's no occupying force less credible and less likely to reestablish an Iraqi state than the United States, the United States having been the destabilizing force. This leaves this earth with a most troublesome situation in that region, and your caller wonders if and how Iran might participate in restoring a balance in the region without making the Earth's other states within and outside of the region uneasy. Does the guest have thoughts on this? Thank you.
Of course, I think that Iran has its own regional as well as international interests. And I think that it's also very important that destabilization of Iraq was not quite to the benefit of Iranians as well, because Iranians are quite worried about the spread of this violence into their own territories. They do want to see a weaker Iraq as opposed to Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And I think that we need to learn in the U.S. that another regional player, such as Iran, should not always be perceived as a competing power against U.S. interest in the region. Of course, U.S. has its own interests. Iran does have its own interests. And there are ways, and these interests are not necessarily irreconcilable. And the Iranians are very, very much aware of that. And I think that Iran can truly offer a stabilizing effect throughout the region. Iranians, again, contrary to what we hear all the time, are Iranian, when I say Iranians, I'm referring to Iranian government, of course, are quite pragmatic. They are much less ideological than what we have perceived them to be. And they understand that a stable region is economically useful for them. They understand a stable region is good politically for them because they don't want to deal with any kind of unrest in their own country. They don't want to see that their authority being eroded by all these unrest in the region. So in that sense, I think we need to understand that a strong Iran is not necessarily a threat to the U.S. Because, again, a democratic Iran is not going to be necessarily a very pro-American government. And this is the other lesson we need to learn, that we cannot divide the world into pro-American, anti-American camps and understand pro-American governments, democratic governments, and anti-American governments as non-democratic, tyrannical governments. There is another alternative. There are possibilities of having more democratic governments around the world, and including in the Middle East, which are not quite on the sort of friendly side with the U.S., but there are kind of governments that they can live with the U.S., they can negotiate with the U.S. on the U.S. interest in the different parts of the world. And in that sense, we need a new mindset, and we need to understand that we cannot behave in a post-colonial world like an empire anymore. This is a very, I thought it was very insightful of Brzezinski, who mentioned that the problem with the Bush administration is that it's behaving like an empire in a post-colonial world. Mm. And that time is over, and the U.S. is a little bit late to act like that. And we need to understand that and treat other governments, other sovereign nations, as equals in the world politics.
Well, then, you know, when we talk about, when we ask this question, how can the relationship between Iran and the United States be improved? It seems that here we always look at that through our own lens, and primarily what we're saying is, how can Iran behave differently so that we can have better relations? It's all on their, we'll put it all on their side. We don't ask the question, well, you know, should the United States do something differently? No, we always say, well, what are they going to do differently? So having said that, though, if let us suppose that we did have a more reformist government, whatever that means in the Iranian context, come to power in Iran, whether that how much we should expect the relationship between the two countries to change if indeed the United States doesn't change at all. Does that really make very much difference?
Well, the U.S., believe it or not, the issues between the U.S. and Iran are not that complicated. They're very, very simple issues at stake here. Mm-hmm. And obviously the one basic fundamental issue for the U.S. is to recognize the Islamic Republic as the sovereign government of Iran. And at that point, I think And give Iranians security assurances that the U.S. does not intend to topple Iranian government. And that recognition means a whole lot for Iranians. And the U.S. should come to terms with, finally, after 27 years, come to terms with Iranian revolution and recognize this government. And then after that, There are outstanding issues between the two governments, like the U.S. had frozen Iranian assets after taking over of the American embassy in Tehran in 1979. Iranians obviously should acknowledge that taking over of American embassy was a mistake. And whatever the U.S. has done in Iranian history since 1953 to 1978, supporting the despotic regime of the Shah, does not justify taking over of American embassy in Tehran. And the Iranian government should recognize that, acknowledge that. And obviously, it doesn't cost Iranians anything, and it's sort of a political move on their part, and give the U.S. embassy in Tehran back to its rightful owner, the American government, and the U.S. should release Iranian funds. Mm-hmm. And this is a very, very simple issue to do, but nevertheless, it's a huge step towards the normalization of relations between the two countries. And and of course, you know, it requires political will. Iranians have shown that they have the will, but how they are managing that domestically is a big issue. And now Iranians are negotiating with the American representatives in Baghdad directly face-to-face after 27 years, and that was a big step. And I think, you know, the future administrations in Iran might continue that, and the U.S. should recognize that and try to expand that relationship and reestablish diplomatic relations. And I can't really think of very complicated issues that why the two countries cannot reestablish their normal relationships. There are parts of the world that the situation is much more complicated than between the U.S. and Iran. But I think it's a doable thing. It's a very simple thing to do. And it just requires a certain political will on both sides. Yeah.
We have time perhaps for one more caller here. Quickly, we'll go to Urbana for the next. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I think what resonates and alarms American people is Ahmadinejad's statement that Israel should be wiped off the map, and this sounds very much like Hitler when he was making his bellicose statements, and he certainly followed through. So the next question is, do we want to confront Iran before they are a nuclear power or afterwards? And the answer there is obvious.
Well, how do you understand, how are we to understand the kinds of things, particularly the kinds of comments that the Iranian president Ahmadinejad has made about Israel? What is that about?
Right. There are two things that I think Ahmadinejad is playing to a domestic audience and a regional audience. And the comment was made before the meeting of Conference of Iran, the Organization of Islamic Conference, where there were rumors that the Saudis were introducing a proposal for the recognition of Israel. And Ahmadinejad made the comment right before the meeting and basically changed the entire agenda of the conference. So Ahmadinejad is vying for the leadership of Muslim population in the Middle East, and he made the comment in that context. Of course, the comment itself, I do not condone the comment, and I think that it should be condemned, any kind of rhetoric that violates basically the UN Charter. And but also we need to understand that, again, that comment is made in the context of a similar kind of comments that Israelis are making against Iran. And Ahmadinejad explained that when he mentioned the wiping out of Israel from the map, and he also mentioned that Israel, I mean, this is a problem of translation, a little bit a problem of translation into English of his comments. He said that Israel would disappear exactly the same way that the Soviet disappeared. So the Soviet disappearance of the Soviet Union did not mean the annihilation of the Russian population, obviously. And And of course, Inge, again, this is a political issue, and I think that this is a political rhetoric. I don't think that there is any kind of comparison between his comments and, you know, German Nazi situation of the final solution. I think the comparison is really uncalled for. And Iran does not have any plan of attacking Israel. And it just is trying to create a situation for the protection of its own border rather than attacking any other country. Iran has a vibrant Jewish community, and it's a mistake to think that the comments were made from a position of a complete anti-Semitic president. Iranian Jewish community is still vibrant, and they have a representative in the parliament, and it's a misplaced problem that to think that Iran is compared to pre-World War II Germany.
Right. Well, we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. I want to thank our guest, Behrouz Ghamari Tabrizi. He's assistant professor of history and sociology here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.